The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you can't encourage them to come over here, then you need to encourage them to commit an attack in your hometown. So what we saw was a hand-holding, right? So an individual in Ohio reached out to a guy named Junaid Hussein, who was a prominent British ISIS member, and said, you know, I'm thinking about joining ISIS. What should I do? And Junaid said, you know, what you should do is kill a military officer in Ohio. And here's a link to an Amazon link to buy a knife to behead him. Here's how you should drop the video on Telegram to us when you're done. And once you're done that, maybe we can talk about you joining the Islamic State. And so we had, I don't know, something north of 26 deadly attacks in the U.S. A not insignificant number of those people were tied to this Legion of Doom in Syria, hand-holding these Americans. And in fact, once DOD and the FBI connected together and started systematically killing these people and taking them off the battlefield, we saw the number of plots in the U.S. dramatically drop.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 16th, 2020. The Islamic State in America. It's a topic that once garnered front page headlines, but has fallen a bit out of public attention in the past year or so. I sat down with Seamus Hughes, the author, with Alexander Meligrew-Hitchens and Bennett Clifford of Homegrown, ISIS in America. We talked about their new book and how the Islamic State has attracted American followers, how the organization operates differently in the US versus Europe, and we talked a whole lot about the FBI and the role it plays in countering homegrown extremism. And finally, I picked Seamus's brain about what he's most concerned about going forward. It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 16th. Homegrown, ISIS in America. So before we dive too deep into any one area, just talk to me a bit about the state of play of ISIS in America. So when we talk about people arrested or investigated for involvement in the group in America, how many people are we talking about? And are there any particular areas of the country where they come from most frequently, or any other big picture trends that stick out to you?
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway is it's a relatively small phenomenon. You know, the FBI talks about 1,000 active investigations in all 50 states for ISIS-related activities. We've charged something north of 200 people with ISIS-related crimes in the last 5 years. Those numbers obviously picked right up in 2015 and 16 timeframe when they announced a caliphate. That was a really big driver for Americans to go want to travel overseas. In terms of like where they're coming from, you know, we've got an arrest in at least 26 different states, but there are some hotspots, right? So in Minnesota, for example, you had, you know, a dozen people try to go join the Islamic State. And that it was much similar to a dynamic in Europe, right? So the folks that went to go travel from Minnesota tended to be folks that were the brothers, sisters, and roommates of individuals who went to join Al-Shabaab in Somalia a few years before that. So in-person networks matters a great deal when you talk about ISIS recruitment in the US. But again, you're talking about the story of ones and twos and not fours and fives in the US. They tended to be connected online. They tended to reach out through social media. They didn't tend to get recruited at, say, Times Square with a leaflet.
And I think sometimes when ISIS in America gets covered, it's sort of the coverage of people who get sucked up into it falls into two sort of categorical ways of thinking about it. One is that, you know, basically everyone who gets caught having some affiliation with ISIS was trying to go to Syria or trying to go to Iraq. And the other way of thinking about it the more sort of worry focused way of thinking about it is that everyone who gets arrested was trying to plot something in the US. But in reality, as you sort of describe in the book, the picture is much more mixed. So can you just talk about what's the breakdown in terms of the number of people who are actually trying to plot attacks versus the number of people who were sort of maybe aspirationally trying to make it over to Syria, or even the number of people who actually ended up making it over there?
Yeah, it's a bunch of different buckets. But if you look at it, most of the American ISIS supporters tended to want to travel to Syria and Iraq, right? The announcement of a so-called caliphate was a driver for a lot of our folks. Now, of course, there's always people that want to watch the world burn. But a good number of individuals we interviewed for the book, returning foreign fighters, talked about this idea of building this so-called utopian society. So they saw this idea of going to ISIS as an opportunity to do some societal building, which is kind of counterintuitive when you look at beheading videos and you think to yourself, how can somebody ever join that group? But that really was a driver. And it's a reason why you had 70 plus arrests in 2015 and 16 timeframe, because of this idea of coming over there. In terms of like domestic plotting, about 25% of the cases involve some level of domestic plotting. Now, I should caveat that saying you don't know what you don't know. And just because a criminal record doesn't say that an individual wanted to shoot up the Mall of America doesn't mean he didn't. But you do see kind of when it involves domestic plotting, it's usually because they haven't been able to get on a plane. They're on the no-fly list and they want to do something here. And so those tended to be the later cases. When things got bad in Syria and Iraq for ISIS, people focused their anger inward.
And so with that in mind, before we dive too deep into the radicalization process, I think one thing that might be helpful would be to dispel some misconceptions about ISIS in America. So what do you feel like people get wrong most often when they're talking about the presence of the group in America?
I think people tend to think that it's a huge phenomenon. You see the nightly news and it says ISIS member arrested in Virginia. Well, they had an ISIS flag on their Facebook account. And yes, they did like ISIS, but it wasn't like they did that with six other guys at their house, right? It tended to be ones and twos on this dynamic. We're not talking about a full-scale recruitment. I would say, though, that when we pull back the curtain, you realize that a lot of focus on the online space, right? So the fact that people are online is important for radicalization. But like I said, when somebody gets arrested, the AP looks at a Facebook account and sees an ISIS flag and says, oh, well, look, that's Facebook radicalization. When in actuality, they tended to be online, but online next to their best friend, watching Iraqi videos together. So an in-person kind of radicalization does matter. You're more likely to join a terrorist organization if your best friend joins a terrorist organization. And that's one of the big takeaways from this. The other takeaway, too, is ISIS didn't have a support network in the U.S. In fact, the U.S. doesn't have really a large history of homegrown violent jihadist activity. It tends to be a relatively small phenomenon. Unlike in, say, in the height of ISIS, when you were in Birmingham in the UK, you could find the guy who can get you over there. Right? That's a little bit harder when you're in Iowa trying to figure this out. And so because of that, they did end up reaching out online quite a bit. And then finally, I think probably the most important part about all of this is the law enforcement apparatus. So the US has a pretty aggressive approach when it comes to law enforcement takedown of ISIS cases. They've got something called the Material Support to Terrorism Clause, which allows them to interject themselves in the process at a very early age compared to their European counterparts. So these networks don't form up because the individuals are talking to two undercover agents and one informant. It just doesn't allow for a cell to grow.
So the last little bit of helpful context, I think for me at least when I was reading the book, is the book is about the Islamic State, but you do a fair bit of talking about how Al-Qaeda functioned in the United States and the differences between Al-Qaeda, which is sort of predated at its most popular level, the Islamic State, and the way that the Islamic State works. So it's a huge question, but how has the Islamic State differed from Al-Qaeda in its approach to and sort of successes in the United States? And what do you feel like ISIS learned from the way that Al-Qaeda did or didn't work in the US?
So Al-Qaeda was, the early age of Al-Qaeda, they were more interested in kind of the broad-based messaging, right? Think of the old school Adam Gadans of the world. An American from California became a propagandist for Al-Qaeda. He'd sit in front of a rock for 30 minutes and drone on about how you needed to do this and this for Al-Qaeda. But it was a megaphone type of approach, right? You're just kind of shouting out to the wind and hoping someone listens. Where ISIS took a different approach. which is they had a committed set of folks, English speakers, who would systematically reach out to ISIS supporters in America and connect them online to people that could get them over there. And I think probably the most important part of all of this is ISIS had a product to sell. Right? The so-called caliphate was a driver. It was the reason why a lot of these Americans decided to travel. Al-Qaeda just didn't have that safe haven and that, for lack of a better word, positive propaganda they could push out, you know, the candy out to kids in Raqqa and electricity in Mosul type of approach. So that was really a big pickup for us. You know, I think of, there's a case out of Texas, a guy named Warren Clark, right? And so Warren Clark's an African-American convert, about 6'2", with a lazy eye. He's a very interesting character, right? And we were tracking Warren for quite a while. And I had a friend who was from Iraq, and their family house got taken over by ISIS. And then when the Iraqi forces took back Mosul, there was a series of documents still sitting in that house. That house was kind of nice, and so all the foreign fighters were there. And in that stash of documents was a resume and a cover letter from Warren Clark from Texas. And the cover letter said, you know, "Dear Islamic State, my name is Warren Clark. I have a good history of teaching English in high school in Fort Bend, Texas, and I believe my skill set would be useful for the Islamic State at the University of Mosul," right? Now, that doesn't jive with what we think of when we think about an ISIS recruit, right? What you saw there was Mr. Clark was very interested in this idea of societal building, however wrong that is, right? And so you did see this romanticization of the caliphate and a lot of these Americans wanting to go there because of it.
And how did that sort of narrative build up in American circles? So it was one thing that really struck me reading the book is that there really is a significant number of people who at least will say that they weren't going over there for any sort of violent purposes. They just wanted to be a part of this lifestyle and this caliphate. How did that message make its way from Syria and Iraq to America?
Well, largely through social media. I mean, we're seeing it right now, and when you look at social media's clampdown on disinformation, but they were just as haphazard when it came to ISIS. In 2015, Twitter was a platform of choice of ISIS recruits. And so you had a number of, for lack of a better word, rock stars online who were in Syria systematically reaching out to Americans here and connecting them with facilitators who could get them across the border in Turkey. And so they took an outsized role. And it was basically a democratization of radicalization recruitment. And so if you wanted to have a question about what was going on in Raqqa, you could DM somebody and ask them that question. It lowered the bar for recruitment in a way we hadn't seen before. You know, it reminds me a lot of, you know, when we started doing some of this work, we looked at a young woman from the Midwest who was a recent convert to her faith. She had questions about her faith and she put them out on Twitter and said, like, "I don't know what's going on. Can someone explain it to me?" We also watched a known ISIS recruiter answer her questions in a very innocuous way, explain what's going on in Syria, but never really bring up anything on ISIS, and then slowly introduce the ISIS ideology and narrative into the conversation over the course of a few weeks, and then move her to secure platforms from there to help facilitate her travel. And that's usually what would happen. There's a grooming process throughout the entire thing. You know, we saw a case out of New York where a gentleman wanted to go join the Islamic State, and he reached out to a planner who was a operative in ISIS and said, "I want to come join you." And the planner said, "Yeah, that's great. You know, first thing you need to do is go kill someone on New Year's Eve for us, and then we'll send a bomber jet to come pick you up," as if ISIS had a bomber jet. But in that process, we also saw that that gentleman got handed off to a number of other virtual planners in Syria at the time, because ISIS realized that he was an asset and wanted to make sure that he was always on. And so they would trade back their phones to answer his questions at all hours of the night to make sure that he never had a moment where he didn't hear from ISIS.
And so what you're describing is a more diffuse network of people who have some involvement in the recruiting process and, you know, speak English. But there's also, and you talk about this a pretty good deal in the book, there's a group of concentrated English-speaking guys who play a really big role in recruiting people in the Anglophone world. Talk a bit about who those guys are and what sort of the organizational structure that they use to find and keep in touch with Americans.
Yeah, so the FBI calls them the Legion, or the Legion of Doom in very dramatic FBI fashion, right? These are six or seven English language individuals in Raqqa who are all sitting at the same computer lab, trading phones, and systematically reaching out to Americans here. And so ISIS basically gave them runway. And they said, listen, your job for 12 hours a day is to reach out to Americans and Europeans and encourage them to come over here. If you can't encourage them to come over here, then you need to encourage them to commit an attack in your hometown. So what we saw was a handholding, right? So an individual in Ohio reached out to a guy named Junaid Hussein, who was a prominent British ISIS member, and said, you know, I'm thinking about joining ISIS. What should I do? And Junaid said, you know, what you should do is kill a military officer in Ohio. And here's a link to an Amazon link to buy a knife to behead him. Here's how you should drop the video on Telegram to us when you're done. And once you're done that, maybe we can talk about you joining the Islamic State. And so we had, I don't know, something north of 26 deadly attacks in the U.S. A not insignificant number of those people were tied to this Legion of Doom in Syria, hand-holding these Americans. And in fact, once DOD and the FBI connected together and started systematically killing these people and taking them off the battlefield, we saw the number of plots in the U.S. dramatically drop.
So that, I mean, in some ways that makes sense, right? That a relatively large number of the attacks and attempted attacks in the U.S. had to do with these guys. But what about the ones that didn't? So how about the people who didn't have any sort of interaction with this type of extensive interaction with people in Iraq and Syria? What are some general trends that you noticed that sort of move these people from passive interest to active attack planning and execution?
Well, first of all, they tended to be unsophisticated attacks. So a gentleman in Ohio drove his car through a university and injured a number of people. A similar vehicular attack in New York. They tended to be not well-coordinated attacks, one-off events, a knifing at the Mall of America in Minnesota, for example. The trigger usually is that, you know, most of these, if not all of the cases of a deadly attack in the U.S., it occurred after an FBI investigation had already started. So these individuals knew they were under investigation. Maybe the FBI decided to close the case or continue on, but they knew they were under investigation, so they knew they couldn't travel, and so they focused their way inwards. Now, the outlier on this when we come to talk to sophisticated attacks would be Omar Mateen, the gentleman who killed dozens of people at the Pulse nightclub a few years ago. And that was an individual who staked out his attack plan, had a number of guns, and planned it out pretty systematically. And he did it, obviously, for a call for ISIS. In fact, the 911 call, he announces he's doing it because DOD had killed an ISIS member and that he had been a big fan of. But most of these attacks tend to be relatively unsophisticated. Deadly, but unsophisticated.
And how does that compare to the world of Al-Qaeda attacks?
Yeah, it's similar to the homegrown terrorist attacks that were inspired by Al-Qaeda, but I think the contrast here would be attacks in Europe. So a number of attacks in Europe were coordinated and executed by returning foreign fighters, individuals who spent time in Syria and Iraq. Contrast that with the U.S., where we've had something like 24 individuals come back from their time in Syria and Iraq. Most of those individuals come back disillusioned, disenchanted. Only one of those individuals came back with the express plan to commit an attack here at the homeland.
So you had mentioned this a bit earlier, but there are real differences in the way that ISIS operates in the US and in Europe. And I wonder if you could just tease that out a bit more. So you had talked about how, in particular, in Europe, you find real concentrated clusters of people and there are specific neighborhoods in which you can, you know, find relatively high numbers of ISIS sympathetic people. In the US, that just doesn't really exist. So talk a bit more about that and how that sort of shapes the different ways that that ISIS has evolved in America versus in Europe.
I mean, that's an important point. I think when you look at Europe, the perfect example would be Sharia for UK, which, you know, had dozens of members go join the Islamic State. And you had handouts and leaflets and people setting up tables on the streets talking about how great the caliphate was. Now, it was never explicit like how great ISIS was, but it was the general idea of a caliphate was pretty good for them. And I think that's the takeaway from the book is, you're more likely to join a terrorist organization if your best friend joins a terrorist organization. Contrast that with the U.S., you know, nobody's handing out leaflets at Times Square about how great the Islamic State is. We just don't have that network here. I hearken back to what I talked about before. That's because our law enforcement approach is much more aggressive than our European counterparts. We can't discount the material support to terrorism clause. So that allows for the FBI to interject themselves in the process so much sooner than anybody else in the Western world. So the idea of a material support, so providing yourself to join ISIS, that's enough for an arrest in 20 years. And so you drive to O'Hare Airport, you're getting picked up pretty quickly. Whereas in the early days of ISIS, travel to Syria and Iraq wasn't inherently a crime in Europe, right? So you had numbers of 5,000 folks who traveled over there. Contrasted that to the U.S., where we had something about 300 people who attempted to or did travel to Syria and Iraq. Relatively small numbers. Now, there's also the no-fly list, so that makes things a little bit more difficult for American jihadists. And we also can't discount geographical location, right? It's a little bit harder to have to get on a plane, go to Turkey, and cross the border than it is when you're in Europe.
And so when you're reading this book, and even when we're having this conversation, the part of the U.S. government that comes up time and time again is the FBI. So just talk about just how big of a role the FBI and federal criminal law in general, particularly the material support statute, plays in countering homegrown extremism in the U.S.
I mean, it's the elephant in the room. You know, the FBI had active investigations in all 50 states, so there's 1,000 active investigations. They also had a number of individuals trolling online looking for supporters. And so time and time again, when you look at arrest in America, you realize an individual, an American, will reach out to an ISIS supporter, get pretty far along in the process, and then fast forward to when they get arrested, and that person they reached out to was an undercover agent. In fact, they got so good at it, actually, that the FBI started connecting would-be supporters with FBI informants. So you had a bunch of ISIS operatives working out of Raqqa who would get pinged by Americans and saying, I want to go join ISIS. And the guys in Raqqa would say, okay, that's great. You know what you should do? You should talk to my trusted friend, this guy online. He'll help you get there. Well, that guy online was an FBI informant. The FBI had already kind of set up the whole system to take it down. And you're talking about a large apparatus, you know, 56 field offices, 200 plus joint terrorism task force, all coordinating at the state and local level for this. We also saw a relatively large coordination at the state level too. So particularly for minors. So if you were a 16-year-old kid thinking about joining ISIS, the Department of Justice was loath to charge you with material support to terrorism for a variety of reasons, many of which I believe are valid, right? But the state and local officials had no hesitation to charge someone with a gun charge if you're a 16 or 17-year-old who's thinking about joining ISIS. So there's a level of coordination between the two organizations. And like you said, the material support to terrorism clause, I keep going back to it, but you really, it's just the story of prevention of widespread recruitment in the U.S. Now, you know, my colleagues in civil liberties and civil rights organizations will say that is way too broad of a statute. It allows for way too much of freedom for law enforcement to police extreme thoughts. But just from a purely practical standpoint, it is quite effective.
So actually, I think it might be interesting. Walk us through a bit how the material support statute works and how it plays into FBI investigations. So what is the line between, say, you know, First Amendment protected speech and something that would plausibly put you over the line into material support land? And how does the FBI navigate that line and use that line to their advantage when doing these investigations?
Yeah, so there's the Bible of the FBI, which is the DIOG, right? The Domestic Investigations Oversight Guide, which gives you a rundown of exactly how you can open up an assessment or preliminary investigation or a full field investigation when it comes to terrorist investigations and when to file for FISA and things like that. So the material support clause, it has to include an action, right? So it's not one thing to talk about how great ISIS is on Twitter. That's not enough to open a predicate to open up an investigation. It has to be an overt action. And that overt action is pretty broad, but it can be, bought a ticket to go to Turkey. That's my overt action. I transferred $50 through Western Union to a guy in Raqqa. That's the overt action. And so once that happens, kind of all bets are off when it comes to an arrest. They tended to prioritize things by connections. So if a gentleman from Indiana was just kind of spouting their mouth off about how great ISIS is, that really didn't rise to the level of a full field investigation. But if that individual was spouting his mouth off about how great ISIS is, and is also DMing Junaid Hussein or al-Sudani or a number of other people, that's when they start jumping in.
And I think one thing that sometimes gets overlooked, so how many material support cases has the government lost in the United States?
Well, a handful, not even 10. So the most famous case in the ISIS cases would be Omar Mateen's wife was charged with terrorism-related activities. The Department of Justice argued that she helped Omar stake out the Pulse nightclub. Ultimately, a jury of her peers found that to be not true, and she was acquitted. But, you know, DOJ is generally batting 1,000. Now, so they'll say, yeah, we're batting 1,000, but you should look at the cases we don't bring up. If you've got 1,000 active investigations and we only charge 200 people, you do the math. We're only bringing the cases that are ready to win. There is some truth in that, but I think, you know, the deck is set pretty good. Most of our folks, the Americans, tended to plead out before they went to trial. You know, they looked at the stats and said, you know, it's probably better to flip and admit to guilt and then hope for a lesser sentence. But, you know, it just depended on the case. The other thing I think to look at is, it's not just the material support to terrorism clause, but also the false statements of the FBI. I mean, that was a thing that the FBI constantly hung their hat on when they didn't have enough of a case to build for a 20-year sentence. They charge an individual for false statements of the FBI. So a great case out of that would be like Saeed Kodamati from South Carolina. Him and his father and his brother go over Syria. They join up with al-Nusra in Raqqa. ISIS takes over the town, and our guy, Saeed, becomes the go-between between ISIS and al-Nusra, one of the few cases of an American who joined two foreign terrorist organizations, right? He gets back to the States after some time over there. He gets stopped at the airport when he lands, and the FBI agent says, hey, listen, Saeed, my name's Joe, FBI, and I have some questions for you. You know, is it true that you ran the Facebook page for al-Nusra? Saeed says, no, I definitely didn't do that. No way, right? So automatically, you now got him from false statements to the FBI because you've got the wiretaps of him posting on Facebook. And so that is, with a terrorism enhancement, 8 years. And so you saw the FBI lean on that quite a bit. Now, there's an end of that tail that I think is important, which is most of these guys are getting out. They got arrested for false statements at this point. You know, we're 5 years into ISIS kind of arrest. And so a lot of these cases, which I think the FBI would say we were very concerned about, but we had to do something so they wouldn't commit an attack, they're now staring at a release date very soon. And so they'll have to figure out what that actually means.
And so related to that, one thing that I think is interesting about the US versus Europe is the relative length of prison sentences for people accused of links to ISIS. So talk a little bit about how sentences in the US work relative to Europe, because I do think that's one sort of important difference between how things work here versus over the pond.
It's orders of magnitude longer. You know, the average prison sentence for a typical European case would be 2 to 5 years if you're lucky in the early cases. The average prison sentence for an ISIS supporter in America is something north of 12 years. And so we've had cases of people getting life in prison for an attempted plot. And so it means that, you know, from the FBI perspective, that's great. You put them away. You know, you don't have to deal with this problem anymore. From my perspective, you know, I'm not sure that solves the issue, right? So, you know, we've been arresting and charging and sentencing Americans for joining terrorist organizations since before 9/11. But let's just go for 9/11, right? If it's been 20 years since then, and the average prison sentence is 12, you know, you do the math, and a lot of these individuals are getting out. And we haven't set up a system in the Bureau of Prisons to do some level of de-radicalization or disengagement or reforming, for lack of a better word. We also haven't set up a system for probation services. So probation for ISIS supporters is all over the map, right? So you've got judges that will sentence someone to 6 years for false statements to the FBI and then tack on a life probation of no use of electronics for the rest of their lives. Whereas, you know, another case, they'll get 20 years of a sentence, but, you know, no probation on the back end. It's just, there's no rhyme or reason to how judges determine these sentences. You know, they'll argue that they're looking at sentencing guidelines and examples from the past, but when you look at it, just, it seems to be all over the map. A great example of that would be, you know, yesterday, Sam Elassani, who is a woman from Indiana who traveled to Syria with her husband and her young kids, held a Yazidi as a slave, allowed her son to be in a propaganda video for ISIS holding guns and bombs, gets repatriated here and got sentenced to 6 years yesterday. In contrast, you know, the case out of North Carolina of a former Navy guy who thought about joining ISIS and got to an airport and got arrested, and now he's got sentenced to 35 years. And so the other takeaway from the book is you're better off joining a terrorist organization than attempting to join a terrorist organization if you're going to get sentenced. You tend to get shorter sentences. You tend to get better preferential treatment for Department of Justice. And that seems counterintuitive, but it's really because you've got information to trade that they want, right? You're more likely to get a better deal because you can show them exactly how ISIS operates in Syria versus the guy who gets arrested at Dulles Airport.
One thing that I'm sort of curious to hear you at least describe to listeners is just a general description of what some of the civil liberties objections are to the FBI approach. So there's the whole bucket of people who see different problems with the 1001 statute, and that includes now supporters of Mike Flynn. But I think the more interesting thing would just be to hear in general what are the objections to the way that the FBI has handled these cases.
There's a number of objections my friends and colleagues and civil rights, civil liberties would make. First and foremost, again, is a material support is too broad of a statute compared to most Western countries. It allows for a level of freedom for law enforcement that most countries don't allow for. But probably most prominent, I remember back to my days in the intelligence community working community engagement issues on this. You know, every time I walked to a mosque or community center and talked about how to prevent terrorism, somebody raised their hand and say, well, you guys create all the terrorists, right? You've got agent provocateurs or undercovers who are egging these people on to commit attacks. And if it wasn't for them, none of this would have happened. And so that's a reoccurring theme is this line between, does an informant push an individual towards a path, or do they allow them to have some off ramps to move back into a normal functioning adult? I think my civil rights, civil liberties colleagues would argue that the informants pushed them too far in the process. And barring that, we wouldn't have as many arrests as you can. I would say that, you know, every defense attorney worth their salt has tried to make that argument in a court. Very few have actually been successful on that. And so there's a discussion to be had about secrecy on terrorism investigations that I think we need to have. I was shocked when I did the book how many terrorism cases existed out there that I had no idea existed, because the Department of Justice never issued a press release and nobody really talked about it. And so I don't have a full sense, and I've been doing this for years, I don't have a full sense of the scope of ISIS support in America, the full scope, right? And I say that as somebody who wrote a book on it, right? And so if I don't have a full sense of the scope, I guarantee you policymakers don't, and I guarantee you Congress and the congressional overseers also don't. And so you can't get a sense of whether you're being too aggressive against a threat unless you know what the threat actually is. And so I think it's incumbent on the FBI to allow some level of additional transparency in the process of this. One last thing to look at is cases, like I said, there's a number of cases where the FBI had opened a full field investigation or an assessment or a preliminary investigation against an individual and then closed it, and that individual went on and committed an attack. A perfect example of that would be the Garland shooters, who drove from Arizona 500 miles down to Texas, and they were going to go shoot up a cartoon contest of the Prophet Muhammad. One of those individuals had been on the FBI's radar for almost a dozen years. Now, the FBI would argue, what do you want from us? Like, we looked at this guy, there wasn't enough to bring anything against him, like, case closed. We can't keep watching an individual for 12 years. We have to close it at some point. And that's true. And I think when attacks don't happen, that is a argument that many make and successfully. But when attacks do happen, FBI is the same people who have to get pulled up in front of Congress and explain when an attack happens and be, you know, chided for allowing it to occur, so-called allowing it to occur. So they're in this difficult balancing act right now. But I always tend to be, as a former congressional staffer, I always tend to like oversight, because I think a little sunlight's not bad for a disinfectant, right? But I don't think they necessarily have gotten the sunlight they needed.
And we'll move on from the FBI and law enforcement in a sec. But I do think one thing that the book does do a good job of highlighting is that the job of the FBI, as you mentioned, is not always particularly easy. Like, you know, they do have an extremely high rate of success in court, the Department of Justice does, but the actual investigations can be really, really tricky. And one of the examples that you discuss in the book that I think is maybe most illustrative of that is the case of Mohamed Baylor Jallo. Could you talk a little bit about that case and what sort of what it shows about the challenges of being an FBI field agent doing investigations into the Islamic State in America?
So Jallo is a really interesting case. So it's a former National Guard guy. And we had an opportunity. I don't know. I guess the FBI press office was asleep that day, but somebody let us interview the FBI agents who worked that case. So I'm appreciative of that. But we sat down with the agents in the Washington field office and talked about that case. And Jallo had traveled from Virginia, went over to Nigeria, connected up with an ISIS supporter there, and was on a bus on his way to Libya, if you'll believe that, wanting to go join ISIS. And damned if the bus didn't have a flat tire and he couldn't get all the way. So he turned back around and came back to the States, right? So Jallo gets back to the States and it's generally a run-of-the-mill case at that point, except for he starts reaching out to this one of the members of the Legion, right? So a guy named Sudani, and said, you know, I'm in the States and I would really like to join ISIS. And Sudani says, listen, it's not going to happen. You tried it before. Do me a favor. Send me some money, first of all, because Sudani always liked money. And it was a way for him to see if someone could be trusted, because the FBI is not going to send him any money. And the Sudani also said, why don't you talk to my guy and my guy can help you? Well, what Sudani didn't know is his guy online was an FBI undercover agent. And so Sudani, an ISIS member, basically handed off a prospective ISIS recruit to the FBI, unbeknownst to him. But he gets handed off and Jallo rises to a tier one investigation at that point. That's an all hands 24-hour surveillance. Now, luckily, Jallo is a man of routine, so he always goes to work at a certain time. He always gets out. He always eats the same sandwich. He's that type of guy, right? But for a number of weeks, the FBI was parked outside of a van, just literally watching this guy, waiting for something to happen. And it started to come up against Independence Day, July 4th. And they had some chatter based on his search histories that he was thinking about committing an attack at a veterans parade. And that's when everything started blinking red. And so he went to a gun store to go buy a gun. The FBI realized he was walking in there. As soon as he walked out, the FBI walked right in and talked to the guy who sold him the gun and decided that it was go time. Now, I talked to the agents who worked that case, and they described 2015-16 timeframe as a complete blur. You know, you're working 14, 16-hour days. You're not seeing any of your family whatsoever. One of the agents had a number of young family members at home. I think he almost missed a birth at that point. And they were just on all the time. In fact, they had to cancel kind of family picnics at the Washington field office because of the Jallo case. It drags on you. And a lot of these men and women do struggle with that question. That same question that we talked about before is, you know, is this guy legit or not? You know, do I want to jam somebody up for 20 years for this? Or if I don't, and he commits an attack, you know, that's on me, and I've got to live with that reality. That's particularly true when you talk about minors. I mean, the number of FBI agents we interviewed who had cases of ISIS supporters who were under the age of 18 and who desperately, desperately did not want to charge these individuals with material support to terrorism. They just said, they looked at it and said, listen, I can make the case tomorrow. This individual's done this, this, and this. I can do it. I just don't want to. Like, I'm a dad. This guy is messed up, and I wish I had another way to handle it. What you saw is in a lot of the field offices, besides New York at the time, there wasn't a whole lot of handoff between law enforcement and social workers or things like that. And so there are very few options for FBI agents besides an arrest or close a case.
So aside from federal law enforcement, what are the other ways and the other, first we can start with other parts of the US government that have gotten involved to try and prevent violent extremism from the Islamic State in the US? Is it a wide net of actors? Is it at all successful? Or is it really the case that the FBI has sort of monopolized this portfolio?
Yeah, it's basically the coalition of the willing. The FBI is always going to want to hold the case. At the end of the day, they're the ones holding the bag if something bad happens. But you're talking about other organizations like National Counterterrorism Center, which, you know, holds the watch listing standards, which helps run the countering violent extremism program. So de-radicalization and disengagement programs. Department of Homeland Security does a similar thing. But you're also talking about coordination. So if the FBI agent believes someone's going to go travel to Syria and Iraq, you've got to coordinate with CBP to see if there's a travel record there. Or you've got to coordinate with CIA for a pickup of intercepts or NSA, right? And so you've got a lot of different players, but at the end of the day, the FBI is always on the lead on this.
And so even in that response, what I hear you talking a lot about is a focus on individual people, right? So there's someone who's identified at whatever stage of radicalization, and then different parts of the government focus on monitoring that person, making sure they don't pass a threshold of either material support or other sorts of dangerous stuff. Is there any sort of effort to cast a broader net within the government and sort of, instead of focusing just on individuals, doing more systematic prevention efforts?
If you ever want to know the cause of and solution to all the world's problems, depending on where you are, it's countering violent extremism. and so during the Obama administration, there was a push for prevention programs, or CV as it was called at the time. And so the idea was to do broad-based engagement. So after, you know, a bomb goes off in Boston, you put somebody on a plane and you go sit in front of a mosque or community center and talk about the ways to prevent another bomb to go off that doesn't involve law enforcement. And there was a pretty significant push by what we called internally the Group of Four. So DHS, Department of Justice, FBI, and NCTC, to try to coordinate this effort. And there were three different pilot cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Boston, and LA, which were going to be the shining city on the hill when it comes to countering violent extremism. And there was a big White House summit, and President Obama spoke, and President-elect Biden spoke, and it was a big to-do. But when you actually interview individuals that were around at the time, and in fact, I actually worked in government on this issue at the time, it was just, you know, me and three of my friends working it, right? You're not talking about, for the scope of a White House summit, you would hope there's some personnel behind it, but there really wasn't. And that's because there's no built-in advocacy for a process like that, right? On the right, people will say you're being soft on terrorists, you're trying to hug a terrorist, you know, why would you do that? And on the left, you would say, you know, countering violent extremism programs are complete overreach of government processes. You're policing thought, get out of this space. And nobody in the middle is saying, like, we should figure that out, right? Meanwhile, I got to sit with parents of kids who went to go join ISIS or Al-Shabaab and tell them that there's nothing I can do. And that, for me, was always the most frustrating part of it. Like, I don't want, and I don't think a lot of my friends at the FBI would say this either. Nobody really wants to put somebody away for 20 years. Like, the occasional guy who deserves it, yeah, sure. But if given the option, you'd really like someone to be a functioning member of society. But there wasn't a whole lot of options on there. And so as a result, countering violent extremism suffered from being too broad of an issue. Like, it could be the solution to, we're going to do like pick up midnight basketball in Minneapolis, or counter messaging in LA, or mental health programs in Boston, right? If that's how you define CV, then I don't know what the hell CV is, because it's all over the map, right? Everything could be defined as countering violent extremism. And so if you wanted to be effective, you had to narrow it down a bit. And what you saw was a coalescing by civil rights organizations who would systematically call members and community members who were part of countering violent extremism programs and say, do you really want to keep doing this? You need to stop. You're bad for civil rights if you keep cooperating with the FBI. You know, you shouldn't trust them, things like that. And then again, that's all well and good and within their rights, but it's a different story when you're sitting at the Brian Cole Rec Center across the table from a grieving mother who desperately wants their kid back from Somalia, and you got no options, right? There's always signs. You always realize what's happening, but you don't really know how to stop it. And if you're a parent of a kid who's thinking about joining ISIS, like, what are your options right now, right? Are you going to call the FBI and look at your son behind a prison bar for 20 years? Or are you going to do nothing and then watch your son die in Syria? Those are crap options, right? And we should do better than that. And that's why I've always thought there should be at least some narrowly tailored prevention programs. Now, there's a part in the book, the last chapter of the book, which I guess is the sunniest part of the book, which provides some level of a possible way out. The Eastern District of New York, which has never been known for being particularly soft on terrorism, right? They prosecuted more terrorists than I think most other districts in the world. They, in 2015, they had an assistant U.S. attorney who was sitting around the table to the FBI threat meetings every week and getting briefed by the FBI saying, you know, this guy's thinking about joining ISIS and that guy is. And the AUSA said, I don't have enough lawyers to prosecute these cases. Like, this isn't going to work for me, guys. We got to figure this out. And so they created an intervention program, which was a bit of a carrot and the stick, where they would knock on a door and say, like, listen, I think you're thinking about joining ISIS. We'd like you to go through this program instead of me knocking on the door next week and arresting you for material support to terrorism. And there was some level of successes on there. They did use a number of former ISIS members to do that. So they would arrest an individual, they would get sentenced, and then as part of their sentencing, they'd have to cooperate and try to prevent the next set of folks from going there. I think there's some promise in that, but you have to be the Eastern District of New York or something like that to do that. You know, if you're working only one case out of Iowa, you're probably not incentivized to try a prevention method. If you're drowning in cases, you have to be creative.
And so those are the parts of the U.S. government that have been involved to different degrees here. There's one other big clump of actors who have had a role in the fate of ISIS in America, and those are the social media companies. So talk a bit about what, first of all, why is it the case that anyone would put responsibility on the social media companies for dealing with ISIS in America? And then what have they done? And in your view, at least, what's been effective and what has sort of fallen short?
Yeah, so social media companies, I think, have a special responsibility when it comes to this issue. And they were asleep at the wheel in 2014-15 timeframe. Twitter was a platform of choice. Facebook was open season. Google Plus was like the king all of ISIS propaganda. I think the only people using Google Plus at the time was ISIS. Right. And so you saw the importance of that. You also saw a kind of a haphazard government response to that. You know, you had people like Jim Clapper flying out to Silicon Valley and saying, like, hey, Eric Schmidt, can you please take down some content for us? Now, I don't even know if that's legal for a government to kind of request that. But that's what was happening is you had the government begging social media companies to do some content moderation. At the same time, you had an internal debate within the intelligence community where, you know, the CIA, the FBI would argue, listen, don't take down that Twitter account. Like, that's a pretty good node for us. And we can just honeypot it for a while and watch that guy. And we can take down 20 more cases. And so don't take that guy down. And so those two arguments were playing out at the same time. Ultimately, everybody fell onto the ground of get them off the mainstream sites and push them up to the corners of the internet. At the very least, you won't be able to get the merely curious. You know, that kid who's thinking about joining ISIS who stumbles across it by looking for news in Syria. And so I think once that happened, once social media companies started hiring up and doing content moderation, we saw the numbers drop a bit. There's a few things to think about, though, and to be concerned about. One is I don't really like ceding an inherently counterterrorism responsibility, a government responsibility to a bunch of private companies. I just think that is just ripe for concern. The other thing is, yeah, you get them off Twitter, you get them off Facebook, but they're going to move to Telegram, and Telegram doesn't really, you know, is more of an adherent to free speech rights than the other social media companies. And there's encrypted issues on that. I think that's less important, but there's encrypted issues on that. The more these guys move from mainstream platforms to smaller niche platforms, the less importance those larger companies are going to play. But also, it's you also need to remember, it's not like the head of Telegram is going to sit in front of the Judiciary Committee and testify about his processes in ISIS. You know, only Mark Zuckerberg and the rest of the crew is going to do that. And so the more you push them away to these niche sites, the more convoluted and confusing it gets. Finally, while the radicalization numbers may drop, right? So the pool of radicalization, folks that stumble across it may drop when you get them off mainstream sites, the mobilization pool gets a little bit larger. And by that, I mean, if you're sitting in on a Telegram channel and all your buddies love ISIS and they talk about how great ISIS is and want to commit attacks in ISIS and nobody else is telling you that you shouldn't do that, there's no dissenting voices. It becomes a hell of an echo chamber to encourage attacks.
All right. So Seamus, we've got to wrap up in a sec, but before we go, I'm curious what your thoughts are about the future of ISIS in America. So at least by my estimation, the headlines about ISIS fighters getting arrested in America are less frequent these days, with the exception of super high profile ones like the so-called Beatles making their way into the US. What do you see as the biggest areas to look out for, areas of concern? You'd mentioned the relatively large number of people who soon will be making it out of prison, but are there other things in particular that you're worried about going forward?
Yeah, I worry about the larger issue, which is a fracturing of the threat. And so the FBI is going to have to pivot from ISIS to Al-Qaeda to Al-Shabaab to now far-right extremists. They've always had to deal with that, but an increasing number. And so you see a hodgepodge of extremists operating in the U.S., and it's a lot harder to get a level of specialized knowledge on each group that you're going to need to know when someone's just spouting their mouth off and when they're actually going to commit a terrorist attack from all of those different groups. I think we're going to go back to where we were in the norm when it comes to homegrown terrorism, at least for the short term. The norm being 20 to 40 cases a year, you know, not the hundreds that we had a while ago. With two caveats. The first caveat is, damned if we haven't had an arrest every month for the last 12 months, but it just gets lost in the noise of everything else that's happening in the world. And the other thing, and I think this is really flying under the radar, is that the FBI and local law enforcement are arresting a lot of these individuals on non-federal charges. And so you're seeing, or federal charges not related to terrorism. So you're seeing a number of cases of individuals getting arrested for a gun charge where nothing in the charging doc tells you it's ISIS, but the FBI knows it's an ISIS case. And so the response is, the reason why they're doing that is they're increasingly concerned about the flash to bang, for lack of a better word, between when they say they're thinking about joining ISIS or committing an attack, right? And so they're moving farther and farther, closer up to the process and arresting these individuals for smaller crimes. We saw that happen in the white supremacist movement too, but increasingly for ISIS. But just like you said, you know, material support gives you 20 years in prison. A gun charge does not. And so, or a drug charge or a state terrorist threat charge in some states is 2 years, right? And so those individuals are getting out quite quickly. And I don't think there's an apparatus to deal with that. I think the vast majority of people will not recommit. But if terrorism is a form of crime, of which it is, you should be worried about recidivism, and all forms of crime have recidivism. And so we're going to have a number of people that unfortunately kind of go back to their old ways on this, and we haven't figured out what to do with that.
And that is all the time we have for today. Seamus Hughes, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to your audio engineer, Zachary Frank, and as always, to Jen Patiahau for producing and editing. Your music is performed by Sophia Yan. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and consider sharing us on Twitter, on Facebook, or wherever else you might think to. And thanks for listening.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.